It's the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate Mildenhall, fresh out of the taxi from Brisbane, how are you?
Well, I'm great, but what I was going to say is that now I'm sitting here looking at myself in the Zoom room, I can now fully appreciate the size of the pimple on my chin.
Oh, I did hear, actually, you should put it, if you put it
you
on
did
a slight
hear,
angle.
They were talking
Yeah, that's right. No, I did hear that, like, one of the reasons we all look so unattractive in Zoom is because we're front on. So now I'm making a point to turn my thing slightly and it gives you a more angular face.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. You know who is the best at that, talking about angles? Last night, the amazing Anita Heiss was at my Brisbane event, and she is not only is she just a general legend in all ways,
she looks like
and in
fun.
All
she
forms
looks like a
and
lot
so
of
much fun.
Fun.
She is like an extreme professional on making sure you get a good shot, like the angle, the look. She checks them. Yeah, we're good to go on that one. She's just spot on. We
I
love
need
you, Anita.
One of those in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, you really need it. I've posted a lot of photos in the last few days, Catherine.
Oh, I know they vary, don't they? My God.
They really do vary.
Now, before we get underway, I did want to mention one particular event of yours that's coming up. Literary Listings are putting this on, and it's an in-convo and lunch with you, Sally Hepworth, and Amy Lovett. How
it
good
is
that?
It's going to be so fun for... It's going to be so fun. It's not till October. It's at the gorgeous Elwood Bathers Club. And I just don't understand how Sally and Amy and I are going to stop talking. So, you know, come along. We will overshare, no doubt. We will talk our latest
actually,
books,
I don't
also creativity.
Know Amy Lovett that well, but you and Sally are definite oversharers.
We are definite oversharers. Yeah, I reckon Amy's got an oversharing capacity. Their stories on Instagram for secret book stuff are hilarious and delve into oversharing. So super excited. And what a great thing for Jill to be hosting with Literary Listings. Very exciting.
Yeah, it's a good one. Now, you literally are fresh out of the taxi. You were messaging saying I'm running late. You've come from Brisbane. You've been in Sydney. But I want to talk about the launch, which was last week in Melbourne. It was a massive event. I feel like there were hundreds of people there. Is that right?
I believe there were 200. There wasn't quite firm numbers. There was, you know, but yes, around that number. It felt rather busy, and I've had to go back through and look at people's photos because, you know, some people had to leave before I got a chance to say hello to them. So I've been forensically going through to check who was there. And
you did.
You know,
you did put a call out on one of the WhatsApp groups saying, can you send me crowd shots? Like, it wasn't even shots of you. It was like, no. I need to see who was there. Very forensic analysis. Tell me, what was the highlight?
Oh, what was the highlight? My goodness me. I'll just go straight to the first thing that comes to mind is that I think we talked about this. One of the things that kept me going in the middle of writing the book was that I imagined launch night, right? Like Melbourne launch night. And at some point during the writing, my friend Penny Russin had said to me, oh, have you seen Waitress the musical and have you listened to this song? She used to be mine. And I hadn't, and I promptly listened to it, and it was like just straight spark. It became my cry, sing very loudly ballad that happens in the car. The kids got onto it. And at some point during that phase to get me through, I was like, I'm going to ask my friend from high school, who's an amazing artist and musician, Louisa Rankin, to sing that at the launch. Like, I'm talking, this was a point where the novel was still in fragments. Like, it was so far from finished. But that is indeed what I asked Louisa to do and what she did. And so she sang that song. and it was extraordinary. And then in the middle of it, my girls came up, could kind of see that I was clearly struggling on the side, and both of my daughters got up and came over and gave me a big old cuddle. So I think that has to be the highlight.
Yeah, that was pretty special to witness. Highlights always beg the question. I don't know why they do things work by contrast, but they definitely do. Was there a low light?
Well, Pizzagate. Obviously, Pizzagate occurred. So let me break this down, because people love the details of launches. So the way that launches normally happen is that your publisher might put in a bit of money and you put in some money. When it's not in a bookstore, which it wasn't, I wanted it to be at Trades Hall. you know, you kind of go both ways. I was pretty sure that my delightful group of friends and family would drink the minimum spend on the bar. So I was, you know, happy to take that bet that would happen. And, you know, I paid for the musicians. My publisher put in for the, you know, the audio tech for the night, and put a little bit on the bar. And then I said, look, I want people to eat because I want them to stick around. So I'm going to get the pizza. And Trades Hall had a preferred pizza caterer. What I didn't realize was that the pizzas were about the size of a small car.
At least a truck wheel, like very, very large. I have not seen a pizza that
big. You know how normally you cater for like slice per person? And I had been I hadn't been generous. I was like, I know that there's 200 people booked in, but we're just going to do it for 150 because I know half my mates won't eat. And yet at the end.
So you went on like a portion of a pizza per person.
Yeah, you know, like a slice. Not knowing that the slice was as long as an arm.
It was like a meal. Yeah.
Anyway,
they were massive.
It was so funny. I don't like the only reason that it was the low light is because they caused such concern to particularly my family, who are, you know, do not like waste. And so there was a lot of distribution of pizza. There was talk of putting pizza in an Uber. There was calling places which might take food. Anyway, everyone got pizza. I think there's some people possibly still using pizza as, I don't know, wedge open a door. Anyway, that was really funny and it amused me greatly.
The Hummingbird Effect is obviously your third book, which makes it your third launch. It's a very obvious way that it was different to the last one, the launch of The Mother Fault having occurred in lockdown. Mm. Aside from that, were there big differences in how you felt on Friday?
It was very buzzy and very joyful. And I think I felt, you know what I think I did do, Catherine? I think I took on board your statement, phrase for the whole year, which was Dylan Alcott's How Fucking Good Is This? And I tried very hard to enjoy it rather than to panic about this thing not being right or this thing not being right like I did. And, you know, there was also an army of people helping me do things so that I didn't have to panic. But it did just feel really damn special. And that's been the same doing the bookshop visits this week, because you can get a panic. Even after the day the book came out, towards the end of the day, I started having this slight panic in my chest that's like, oh, well, that's it. That's launch day done. And now it's only going to go downhill from here. You know, that like we just cannot seem to hang on to the good feeling. But what I think I did visiting all these bookstores, it's also really overwhelming because there are so many books. Yeah. Like not only are there so many books, there's so many new releases. There's so many bestsellers. There's so many books that came out on the same day as you or the day before you or the day after you. There's so many books coming. And so there can be this kind of overwhelm. But I think what was really awesome, or what I've come home with, at least I'm holding on to for this moment, haven't even unpacked yet, is that it made me feel excited that I was getting to have this moment. Like I think someone texted me and said, is there enough buzz in this to get you through the next 4 years, you know, whatever it is till the next book comes out? I'm like, there is buzz. It is exciting walking into a bookstore and seeing your book on the shelf. But the other thing is that it reminds you that your job to do once you've gone and signed the books is to go and write the next book, is like to get back to work, because that's all you can do. Because in 2 weeks or in 2 months or whatever, there's a whole new, everyone's forgotten this book, there's a whole new lot of books. And really all we can do is the work. So that was, it's kind of like a excitement, but also sobering. And you know, that was good. That was a good feeling to have.
Did you run into any other authors while doing the bookshop visits? Who did you go with?
So this time, which I haven't done since Skylarking, I had my wonderful publicist, Anna, with me, which makes such a difference because also they introduce you. You have that feeling. You don't walk in feeling like, oh, gosh, like this is going to be awkward.
You do walk in feeling like someone when you have a publicist with
you. Yeah, when you have a publicist with you.
Makes a big difference.
And which was lovely, and she knew where to go and what to do and all those things. I noted that both Angela O'Keefe, whose new novel is The Sitter, which I'm desperate to read. I loved her first one, Night Blue. She was like two stores ahead of us because I could see it coming up on Instagram, but we didn't meet her. And also Gabby Stroud, who's got a new book out, The Things That Matter Most. She was clearly doing Sydney and, you know, on different days. So that's lovely. But also the other thing, Catherine, which, and we were just talking about this before we started recording, both the number of podcast listeners who came out to events and other writers who came out to events, and I'm not even going to begin to list them because I'll forget someone and then I'll feel terrible, but that was extraordinary and so amazing and really felt like being, you know, part of a community and not only a local community, but it felt like that in Sydney and it felt like that in Brisbane. And I just, that felt very warm and very generous to be part of. And I think that's, you know, what the writing community is. And it's just a really good reminder how people turn up and turn out. And also there were people with new books coming out either this year or next year who kind of asked about the debut crew, and I could put them in touch with debut crew people. And just so, you know, that stuff, that kind of organic stuff that happens just, feels very, very warm and very generous.
Oh, I love all of that. I have a series of quicker questions.
Go. I'm ready to answer.
This related again to the launch. No reading.
No.
What's the rationale?
Well, partly I wrote a really ridiculously complicated book with a lot of different parts in it, and I couldn't choose which part. I had read the night before, or a couple of nights before, when I did this event at the Wheeler Centre, I'd read one of the like COVID sections, which is really tricky to read because it's unpunctuated. And so I had to take a deep breath. But I'd kind of delivered that to a very small, you know, Melbourne crowd. I was like, that is not the vibe that I want to put out on launch night.
Yeah.
And also I love a reading, but a reading is very hard to get right in terms of timing. And especially with that many people in the room, I was super conscious of getting that right. So I just decided not to do it at all, JP and I.
Controversial idea. I don't think I'm going to do readings in future.
Ever? At launches?
Well,
or...
I mean, if I was perchance asked to do something where everyone read, yes, I would. But as a general rule, I don't think I'd do it. Partly for some of the reasons that you're saying. I think it's hard to pick a piece. It's just not my favourite bit. And I think it's, you get to decide.
You do. You absolutely get to decide. I always ask, like, if I'm doing a panel, if I'm leading a panel at a festival or whatever, I say, like, do you want to do a reading? And I know that they can be really successful too. I've had people I've done a reading and they've gone out to buy the book and they've said that that's why they did it.
And I like hearing people read. I like that act of hearing people read their
own. But you've got to get the context and you've got to feel confident reading your own work, which can be tricky. So, no readings. I haven't done them at all except for that one night on Wednesday.
It can be my one thing is in favour of readings is it actually can be a good warm-up, right?
Yes.
It gets you talking in a way
that's no true. Pressure. And as someone who moderates often, it can be if you chuck it in the middle, it can be a nice moment to check in with the audience and kind of work out where you are in your questions and check the timing, et cetera. So, yes.
Maybe I'll change my mind.
See how you go.
I bought a book on the night, but I didn't get you to sign up because there were way too many people. Did you have a special book signature, stamp, phrase, any of the above?
I did not have a phrase. I had a very special pen, which made not an expensive pen, just a pen that I really liked. It was the one they use at Booktopia. And I was like, I like that pen. I'm going to just buy a box of them. And
you bought a box?
Well, it's like a small box. Like, they're not very, we're not sponsored by this. Like, it's a Uniball something, like, not expensive. Yeah, okay. Just right. It worked well. Good color. And Etta, my youngest, had a stamp to stamp.
Huge.
Typically, knowing that this was the thing she was most excited about, she lasted about 15 stamps and then left me to it. My delightful sister then stepped in to do it and also did the checking of names because, Catherine, I can tell you straight up, I only forgot one name on the night. I had to check another couple, which Maggie did to perfection for me in a very calm,
discreet
way.
I'm asking in which, everyone way.
In which only... In the kind of like quick, I had to ask her quickly as you only can a sister and she knows exactly what you're talking about and then delivered. So magical. but she wasn't there when I forgot the name of my cousin's husband, whom I have known for 20 years and it just escaped me. And I just want to make this very clear to everyone who is either attending a launch or who is at their own launch. It is okay. This is what happens. Your brain turns to actual mush, and the best thing that you can do is to, as a standard, if you haven't got someone doing names for you, is to always just ask, how do you spell that? And if their name is Jill and or Rob, that's very funny, but you just say, I have to ask everyone because sometimes I stuff up.
On the topic of guests, who were you most surprised to see?
Who was I most surprised to see? I had good heads up that people were coming. My year 11 literature teacher was there, who is also a poet in her own right, Hermina Burns, who I've spoken about before. But she was there and that was a delight. And also people who were there that I didn't get to see, but I know were there, Kathy and Peter, who own Musk, Where We Go, were there. And I didn't get a chance to say hello before they left. So, a huge thanks to them for coming. I don't know that they listen to our podcast, but hopefully that gets back to them.
I think I managed to speak to you for about 3 seconds.
Yes.
And the reason I made a beeline for you on arrival was because Imbi Neem, author of The Spill, who brings a best launch ever sign to book launches and gets the author to sign it and takes a photo, couldn't make it, but she'd sent me the sign with strict instructions to get you to sign it and to get a photo.
I love that so much. And we got the photo. I mean, we got some great photos. There's great photos of our gang. There's, you know, great photos of everyone. Oh, the person I was most surprised to see was my best mate who'd rocked up from Broome to surprise me. Not only did she rock up to surprise me after like lying to me in the morning on the phone while I was talking to her, thinking she was somewhere in the Midwest, she was kind of shopping for something to wear to the night, having rocked up from the airport, and was in Readings Emporium when I was in there to sign, thinking that she would miss me, that I would already have been in there. And I heard her voice and turned around.
So it actually was a surprise. It wasn't like
surprised her. She surprised me. No, she was meant to be avoiding me so she could rock up in the afternoon with a bottle of champagne when I was getting ready. So that was hilarious because I heard her voice and I was like, that's Erica. And just thought that it was like a lot of feels for the day, but it really was her. So that was extraordinary. But that's what I was going to say on photos. We have not a single photo together the whole night. Yeah, it was just hilarious because that's sometimes what you do. But another piece of advice for people going into their launch, put a couple of people on photos and like what you do for your wedding. If you've got married or if you're getting married, you write down, please make sure I get a photo, you know, with my mum or with my sister or with my kids or with this gang. Have that in your head because it goes super quick.
That's great advice.
This episode, the featured book, is brought to you by Text Publishing, and we are delighted to be talking to Lorraine Peck about her novel, The Double Bind. From magician's assistant to crime novelist, it's all about mastering the art of subterfuge for Lorraine Peck, whose love of crime fiction propelled her to write the kind of book she loves to read. The second son, Lorraine's debut, won the 2021 Ned Kelly Award for Best Debut Crime Fiction from the Australian Crime Writers Association. It was shortlisted for two Davitt Awards by Sisters in Crime and for a Dagger Award by Bad Crime Sydney. Her second novel, The Double Bind, was released in April 2023. I was going to say welcome, Lorraine, but actually it's welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Catherine. It's lovely to be back on your show.
Well, you have the honour of being one of very few, maybe the only, depending on how you categorise things, authors that we've had on the show previously.
Oh, really? Yeah, because it's first time, isn't it? It is supposed to be the first time. Yeah. Or there's your master's classes.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, with way more experienced authors than me.
Not at all. So not only is it your second time on the First Time podcast, but more importantly, The Double Bind is your second book. Can you give us the elevator pitch? What is it about?
Sure. Well, it is the sequel to The Second Son, and The Second Son is about a crime family. It's about a husband and wife, Johnny Novak and Amy Novak. He was born into that crime family and she married into it. And all sorts of complications and upheavals happen and plot twists in that first one, based on a dark secret that Amy is carrying, and the murder of Johnny's elder brother, the first son, if you will, as Johnny's the second son, and he needs to seek revenge. Well, that's what he's tasked to do by his father, who is the Don, if you like, of their crime family. And they have a 10-year-old son, Sasha. If the first book is about whether or not you can escape if you're born into a crime family, and whether or not you will stay when your world explodes around you if you marry into crime, the second book, The Double Bind, is about whether or not, if you have escaped, you can run far enough away. Because the second book starts in, it starts about 2 weeks after the first book. They are standalone books, I must point out, because every book you write has to stand on its own 2 feet. So if you start with The Double Bind, it doesn't matter. But they are, Johnny and Amy Novak, are on the far north coast of New South Wales. It's a town called Hallow's Head, which doesn't exist. But if you really wander around there a lot, which is a lovely place to wander around, you will find that it's probably just about where Lennox Head sits. But I had to fiddle around with the geography a bit.
There's something weirdly appealing about a fake town, I think.
There is. You can do anything you want.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's this place that I spent a lot of time in my youth on surfing safaris and all that sort of stuff. Lots of fun times in Byron particularly. Anyway, they've escaped there. They've run away and they're living up there. Their life is ideal until Johnny gets a phone call saying that there is someone who is out for revenge, shall we say. Now, that character is a special forces soldier, so whose brother died in the first book. So, you know, we've got this special forces soldier who is tracking them down, and we have Milan Novak, Johnny's father, who does not want to let his only son go. He wants him still with him in his life of crime. He can't imagine really letting him go. And we have the Mexican cartels arriving in town because I love watching shows about the Mexican cartels. So they just had to have a part in my book. So they're the kind of uber crime gang. And a police contact in in Sydney, who's now been promoted to the head of the New South Wales, head of the New South Wales Organised Crime Task Force, he needs Johnny to on a special project, shall we say. So, yeah, it's really all about trying to juggle all these threats, mm-hmm. and outwit everyone, which is where that whole double bind comes in. It's a bit like a catch-22. And Amy really comes to the fore now as somewhat of a mastermind, which we didn't really expect. She's such a nice girl from a nice middle-class Aussie family. Turns out she has a criminal mind.
She definitely does. It's interesting because Johnny, as you've mentioned, comes from a crime family, but he also comes from a family that has very traditional male and female roles. And I think Amy in the first book is quite naive, but she's changed a lot by the time the second book starts. When you thought about gender within this story, were there things that you wanted to subvert?
Yes. I have to go back again to writing the first book when the very first draft of the first book was all from Johnny's point of view. All the female characters were very cardboard because I didn't really know what I was doing. I was learning as I went. And when I wrote my first scene from Amy's point of view, it was so freeing and like, oh, wow, this is a, you know, I'm going to have a lot of fun with this character. And a lot of my friends say, well, she's a bit like you, don't you think? And I have had some interesting life experiences, shall we say, that have informed that character and her development. I wanted her to have a stronger role in the, she tells half the story in The Second Son because it is from both Amy's point of view and Johnny's point of view, but Johnny really is the one directing the real action pieces. You know, he's the one in the gang, whereas in the second book, Amy wants to be more involved because if they're going to get dragged back into a life of crime, she wants to make sure that nobody fucks up. So, and she's really smart. So she just gets involved because she kind of has to. And I'm not quite sure whether or not she's enjoying it or not. I think she might be just a little. I think she enjoys being a little more badass than she was in the second song.
She's certainly very brave. I wanted to talk about violence within this book because there are two types of violence. There's violence related to crime and then there's domestic violence. And I feel like as a reader we have a really different response to each. Did you consciously think about the response that you wanted the reader to have in terms of violence?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I really wanted the main subplot to be around domestic violence because it's something I feel passionate about, that we continually sweep it under the rug and don't address it as well as we could. So that really drove the whole subplot about Amy's new friend who comes from a household where, you know, violence is used against her by her husband. And you know, he threatens her, coercive control. He threatens her that he will take the child if she causes a stink or she goes to police. He will take the child, and that happens in so many cases. You know, I read a lot of books around domestic violence in Australia in the lead up to writing and during writing this book, and a lot of stuff astounded me. Especially things like, you know, it takes eight times to leave and all this sort of, these statistics are just insane. So I really wanted to delve into that without it being something that Amy was helping rather than being in the front line, if you will. The violence that happens during the criminal exploit, shall we say, I always try and be really careful about violence, the way I describe things, I don't want to be too forensic. Mm. I use Karen Slaughter as someone whose books I find difficult to read because she's quite forensic about the violence and about the aftermath of violence. It's very physical. She gives you a lot of descriptions of the, you know, the physical wounds, et cetera, that I can't cope with very well. I like my violence dished up with a side of dark humour, if you like. Mm. And so I try not to be too graphic in my books because I don't like reading really graphic, violent crime books. I'd rather be, my imagination is graphic enough without it being described too fully. And I try and make sure that nobody dies unless they really, we feel like they deserve to, or alternately to make the character or the perpetrator very, very evil in the minds of the readers.
Well, your writing of violence is very impactful. I'm interested in hearing you describe it in that way. It's hugely impactful. Like, I feel the two deaths that occur in this book, I can really see them, but thinking back, it really is only a line or two in terms of description. And we see one, I think there's three deaths actually now that I'm thinking. Anyway, however many there are, they're quick but impactful. That's a good way of describing it.
Well, they see, that's okay. See, that's your imagination doing whatever it needs to do to impact you in the way you can cope with being impacted by violence, in my view. Like, I'm not forcing it down your throat. And the other subplot that was something I care about is PTSD in our returned soldiers. And see, that was something that is, you know, it's a smaller subplot than the domestic violence subplot, but it was something that I felt I really needed to do something. I need to do something about. That's the beauty of fiction, is that you can tackle these sort of big social issues in a small way, in a way that you hope makes people think.
That's right. And I think that's how things do find their way into the book. You have this interest at some level and want to weave something in. It kind of builds from there. As listeners might be cottoning on to, The Double Bind has a very, very intricate plot. I am very curious to hear you say, you said off air that you're actually a pantser. So tell me, how does plotting work for you?
It's really hard. And I have to do a lot of walking around the park and the beach and wherever I happen to be. Oops, it's all my earpods popping out. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Because that's where I move the plot along. So I'll just start with a situation. What's the situation Amy and Johnny find themselves in this time? And what characters do I want to introduce? Okay, so, and then off I go. And a lot of the plot just happens as I'm writing because I see everything in front of me like it's happening on a screen. So I'm just typing away what I'm seeing happening in my mind. And then I'll get to a point where I'm like, well, how would that happen? There is various news items come along and pique my interest. For instance, I don't know if you or any of your listeners remember a time, probably 3 or 4 years ago now, where a big front loader was imported into Australia. It was a used front loader from South Africa to Canberra. And the fact that it was a used front loader coming from South Africa pinged the interest of Border Patrol, and they put it through their whopping great big X-ray machine. And they could see these kilo packs of cocaine really clearly on the X-ray machine. And, of course, everyone got busted. So I'm thinking to myself when I hear about this, so how would I bring cocaine into the country? And then away my brain goes and I have to come up with, like, I might come up with, okay, you could do it that way, and then I'll have to spool that back so that I can introduce a business, a way of doing that into the plot earlier. But, you know, if you're a pantser, there are inevitably dead ends that you wander down and you write way more than you really need to because you have to toss stuff out that doesn't work. And I wish I was a plotter. I started this book going, I'm going to plot it. I'm going to plot it out. And I spent 3 weeks plotting it and just got so bored one day. I just thought, I'm just going to start. And that was it. I couldn't stop then.
Yeah, I think you work out what works.
Yes.
Lorraine, I was thinking back to our previous interview and I remembered you'd mentioned vision boards. I am so interested in how people do the kind of career dreaming, goal setting part of being a writer. Are vision boards still part of your creative practice?
Yes and no, but I don't make them, and they're non-fungible tokens now, if you like, in my head. I do.
I love that description. That's a wonderful description of them. Go on.
I do write things down a bit, but I've actually never been a journal writer. Maybe this is why I can't plan things or plot things. I've never written a journal. I don't tend to write a lot of notes for my books. It all just hangs around in my head until I start writing. And every now and then I will scribble something down on the edge of something, on the corner of something else. But basically, if I have a good idea, it will stay there. Surprisingly, I don't know how long that'll last. But when it comes to manifesting, my practice is to meditate. When you get into a nice, you know, what is it, the theta state, then you envisage what you want as though you're already there, you're in it. Mm. You are accepting the Ned Kelly Award, for instance. I'm there, I'm accepting it. How does that feel? Ooh, it feels really good. Yeah, I'm loving this feeling. I'm loving it. So then I'm very grateful for that feeling. Mm. So I just, you know, I throw a lot of gratefulness out into the universe for feeling like I'm already there, and then somehow that pulls me like a magnet towards it.
Mm, I love
that. I'm not quite sure how it works, but that seems to work as well as the old style of vision board I used to make, which was like a PowerPoint. I'm very good at PowerPoint. PowerPoint set to music with lots of images, and that's how I found my husband.
I do remember you talking about that now that you're mentioning it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't do those kind of ones anymore. It's all happening in my head now.
Non-fungible tokens. Is that how?
Non-fungible tokens.
Lorraine, we normally finish by asking for writing advice, but I was going to take a slightly different tact. This is your second book. Second book syndrome is something that a lot of writers, mostly of second books, talk about. Yeah. So firstly, in your experience, does second book syndrome exist?
Yes, because you think the first one was a fluke. And my first book was probably 14 drafts between the first draft and what went to print. And this one was 6. Right. So I'm getting better, but, you know, I'm still learning to do this, and you don't know that you can do it a second time. And I very foolishly sent my first draft off to my editor at text with, you know, great trepidation, but also feeling good about it. And you know, it wasn't well liked. So then you're really on the back foot, like, oh my God, I really can't do this.
It's interesting because some people do seem to send quite early drafts and work with editors at a much earlier stage, and others that doesn't seem to work for.
I would not do it again.
I did the same thing and I wouldn't do it again.
I would not do it again. No, I would certainly be sending it to my agent first and, you know, a couple of other ideal readers and before I did that. Yeah, I think look, it's hard. Writing a book is hard. There's no way around that. While I'm doing it, I love it. And I certainly love it more than the whole editing redraft process. That's always tough. But once you're back into the edit, it's fine. Once you're back into it, but it's getting those notes and going, oh, no, I've got to do it again.
I love that bit. But to continue with that's my favourite bit.
Really?
Yeah. But to continue this writing advice question.
Yeah.
Second book syndrome, we're agreeing it exists. When you are finding writing difficult, what do you tell yourself?
What do I tell myself? I tell myself that I can do it. I'm a pretty confident person. I'm reasonably confident about my own ability because I was brought up in a household that told me that I was, you know, I was special and that I was could be anything I wanted to be and anyone I wanted to be. And so I had a really good upbringing in that regard. I think I have a healthy ego. So when I'm down on myself and I don't think I can do it, I just kind of go, yes, you can, Lorraine. You know, I talk to myself like that. I look myself in the mirror sometimes and go, you can do this. Give myself a solid, you know, right in the eyes. You can do it. Just get back in that office and do it.
Listeners are not getting the benefit of your expression in this this very severe talking to. final question, Lorraine. Do you have a recommendation of a debut book? It can be by any author from any place, any genre.
Ooh, tricky. Looking at my bookshelf right now, and I have to say, I really, 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 really loved Before You Knew My Name, Jacqueline Bublitz. Yeah, I just thought it was so original and different, and I loved that the victim was telling her story and the whole premise, Before You Knew My Name. Before I was a famous, dead, pretty white girl, this was my story. Because, you know, the emphasis is on the fact that because she's a dead, pretty white girl, she gets a lot of publicity and you all know my name. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, that was really good. There's been so many great debuts. So Dirt Town, Hayley Scrivener, you know, that's another one, really good one. I love Danuka McKenzie's work. I love your work. I love both of your books so much. I mean, they're such a nice, for me, they're a real nice holiday from crime because I mostly read crime. I read your books and it's like I am on holiday in a sunny place.
All of that is a wonderful note to end on. Thank you, Lorraine Peck, for your second time on the First Time podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a delight.
I wondered, what are you doing now in the downtime? Did you get a chance to listen, watch, read anything as a distraction?
I have been listening to Yellowface finally.
Oh, I'm reading it at the moment.
Oh my gosh, where are you up to?
No, I just finished it.
Okay, I want to speak about this so much, but I have to finish it first. It feels deeply meta to be listening to this while I'm on book tour. I have squirmed in my seat. I have put my hands over my mouth as I've been listening to it. What?
It's just give me your really good. It's so propulsive, isn't it? I think I read it super, super quick and then probably shouldn't admit it, but went on to Goodreads just to get the analysis. I know reviews are better, but there's something about the broadest.
Three stars immediately?
Check the 3-star reviews. They will
hurt.
Can you
get on and check mine, please? No, don't.
It's an incredible, incredible book.
Just on levels and levels and levels. And you know what's really interesting to me? Because we're both reading it as like, and all the people who've talked to me about it are reading it as writers or people involved in the publishing industry. And yet every shop I went into over the last few days, every bookshop had it in its top 10. I'm like, other people who are not writers or not book publishing people, are they getting the same deep, squirmy satisfaction out of
this? Because there is quite a bit of like the ramifications of Twitter and those kinds of things.
Insider. Oh my gosh, the Twitter storm. Oh, I actually had physical reactions to that.
See, I mean, it's a brilliant opener though too, right? Like just the speed with which she sets up, you know, here is my brilliant friend. Imagine what it would be like to be her. She chokes on a, you know, this
do you
not,
know
this
what?
Giveaway,
I mean, so. We're talking about this and we should be talking about it because I should have collected my thoughts. But the other thing was, you know, do you ever have the feeling like when the cops turn up somewhere or they drive past you and you immediately assume that you're doing the wrong thing?
I've
had the experience the whole time where I was like, oh my God, have I stolen someone's book?
So glad you said that. The whole time I'm riddled with guilt.
I'm sure I've done half the other things that are in there, the publishing, like all the squirmy things, but there's this real moment where you're like, oh my God, maybe I stole my
book. Well, it's a bit like getting on the plane and being like, have I got a bomb? Have I? Like, yes. It's so ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. The logistics of it are quite clever. Like sometimes with a premise, you can see the work the writer has put in to pull off something that's a bit odd. But I reckon she pulls off the fact that the author that dies wrote on a Remington typewriter, that there would be no trace of this book. She actually pulls that off.
She pulls it off. I think what's extraordinary, I haven't read Kwang's other work except for Babel. So I've read that, but I haven't read her other trilogy. And I know that that's kind of in a different vein as well. Just, you know, extraordinary talent, two wildly different books. And I don't know what's going to happen at the end.
Do you think there'll be a potential sequel? That's certainly open for a sequel. But, I mean, I hate talking about whether a female protagonist is unlikable or likable, but she's pretty utterly compelling but completely unlikable. I still find myself on some level rooting for a main character, though.
Yes, and also, I mean, that all the many levels of it also – we're white women writers. That's the extraordinary thing she's pulled off, Kwang has pulled off, is that you're like, oh, that's terrible. Oh, but I feel for her. Oh, but God, I feel for her because I am her. Oh, my God, this is
it's horrible.
Clever and horrible and delightful. And, you know, this is a very immediate emotional hot take and I don't have anything to – I haven't looked at all the reviews and everything
else. It's super left field, though, it would do so well.
So good. What have you – what else? So you've been reading that. What else have you been reading?
The only one I was going to mention was a Barbie movie, which I think you have seen as well, I thought was absolutely spectacular. Like – I was completely ambivalent about Ryan Gosling going in. Now I'm obsessed with him. I love Margot Robbie. I think the final line of the movie is perfection. I don't think you could get a better – it's a mic drop moment. Oh. It's just so goddamn good.
Except that I had to define it for my children.
Yes, also had to do this.
At the same time, looking over their heads at the mum, you know, in the next seats with her kids who was just laughing with me as we defined. I share all of your gushiness. I loved it so much. What I think is interesting, was your response more laugh or cry throughout the movie?
Laugh. I'm actually surprised by the moments that other people have picked out that haven't been as impactful for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So our, you know, mutual friend and podcast friend, Shay, cried from the beginning, from the opening scene with the dolls. Also had moments of laughter, but just the whole thing was so resonant. And whereas I laughed when it got to the Gosling singing Push scene,
Was euphoric?
I really wet myself. Like, I couldn't. God. That's the only point that Etz leaned over and was like, Mum, that's a bit much. Like, so good. And what I thought was so extraordinary is that you could see everyone, all the women in the audience, like, just getting it so deeply. Oh, yes. And it's kind of such a specific moment to be guitared at. And yet it is. It is emblematic of everything, of it all. Oh, God, it's so good. I loved that part.
Yeah, it was great.
I loved everything about it. And also, how did your kids go walking out of it?
They were fine.
Mine just swaggered.
I just had
full Barbie energy.
We were in a Sunday afternoon session. We went with the neighbors, another mum and Tilly's best friend. And there were just so many teenagers in the session. I think that the girls were probably eyeing off all these girls in crop tops and, you know, slightly older.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a female heavy audience.
And also, I love that in a way, I haven't dived deep on criticism and all the rest of it,
neither.
Partly because it's been so amusing to see them just turn around some of the criticism, like all those one-star reviews from the men. I just turn it around and turn it into marketing. Obviously, the marketing budget was extraordinary, and like, good on them. They just raked in $1 billion.
But yeah, like, amazing.
I feel like, especially someone who's just written kind of an anti-capitalist novel, like that, for me, that criticism doesn't stick as much. Like, I get it. It's Mattel. I get it. But also at some level, it's done something really crazy. I'm a fan. I'm a well and truly fanned up about this movie.
Just small point was hearing about some of the Barbies that existed.
Oh, my gosh.
Just like terrible. There was one that like the boobs of Barbie grow. So you went from like young girl Barbie to teen Barbie. And
just
some terrible ideas of
terrible
what could be fun, really bad.
Terrible ideas. I'm so glad really we bad. Are both in Barbie love. Yeah. I think I want to go see it again, actually.
I actually would see it again, and I wouldn't say that about many things. No. Before we finish up, let's talk events. What else is happening?
This week, I've got some really lovely ones. I get to be in conversation with Kate Kennedy in Castlemaine.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, with Northern Books. That's on Tuesday, the 15th. And then my local kind of event with Eltham Bookshop, my darling Eltham Bookshop, which is on Thursday the 17th. I'm off to Canberra Writers Festival, which is going to be fun. I get to talk to Paul Delgano and Mirandi Rewo about her new book, Sunbirds, which is out very soon. And the other one I just wanted to mention because I'm such a fan of Tasmanian writer Maggie McKellar, whose book Graft, I think I raved about on here. And we've got a very special event with Verso Books in Healesville at the Healesville Pub. It's for lunch. There are only 20 tickets and I think a bunch of them are gone. It's on Saturday, the 26th of August. So we'll put links to all of these on, but that'll be a conversation about both of our books and about creativity. And I'm really looking forward to it.
I love that. I've got one event I want to mention. It is Emily Spurr's upcoming book launch for her second novel, Beatrix and Fred. Have you read her first book?
No,
Oh, you've got it. You're holding it up.
I'm holding it up here, but I have not started reading it yet, but it looks very beautiful and I'm excited about your launch for her.
It will be good. Multiple places I've seen have descriptions of this book and they use the word weird and I love that word in the description. Great word.
I also love weird and blackly funny will get me every time.
Yeah, good combo. It's Wednesday, 30th of August at the Sun Bookshop in Williamstown, Yarraville. So I'll link to that in show notes as well.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.